Okay, a couple announcements that I would like to make right at the beginning. First of all, you should have three handouts from last time. The syllabus, a two-sheet Palestinian chronology handout, and another one on, entitled Hypothetical Tells. If you weren't here last time and don't have that, we do have a few extra copies available at the back of the room here on the table. Also, if you paid last time, your 20 JDs, Linda has the receipts at the back. And if you didn't pay, she'd be happy to collect the 20 JDs this time. Also, I got word just the other day, and this might be especially of interest to those of you who have had Jim Sauer's pottery first, that Ruth Almaron's book on the ancient pottery of the Holy Land, which has been out of print for quite a while, is now back in print, but there are a limited number of copies. The only place you can get them that I know of is Jerusalem, and we have a contact over there in the Albright Institute who said that he would be happy to order them for us, and I'm sure we can figure out a way to get them back. We do have some people going across the bridge in the next week or so, so I'd say if you're interested in obtaining a copy of The Pottery of Palestine, there's some problems with the book, but it's still about the best thing you can use this for, the pottery of this area. If you would, again, at the end of the lecture, sign up at the back of the room indicating that you do want to order the book. They are approximately $35 a copy, or about 11.5 JD. In fact, they may be a little bit cheaper. They were going for $30, and this week the price was going up. So I might charge $35 and then give you a rebate if you overcharge. So don't forget, if you'd like a copy of this, please sign up at the back of the room after the course. Also, I'd like to announce that Ted Banning, our Albright Fellow, is going to be giving two lectures in March, one on the 6th and the second on the 20th. Both of those are Saturdays at 6:30 in the evening. And Ted's going to be talking about modern archaeological survey techniques in the first lecture on the 6th. And then on the 20th, he'll be talking about his recently completed archaeological survey of the Wadi Ziglag. Okay, another lecture announcement, and that is this Thursday, February 26th at 6:30, Dr. Fawzi Zayadeen of the Department of Antiquities is going to be delivering a lecture at the French Cultural Center. I don't know the exact title, but it'll be something like Recent Archaeological Excavations of Petra. Does everybody know where the French Cultural Center is? It's at 6:30.
What night is it, in French or English?
I'm pretty sure it will be in English.
Really, at the French Cultural Center?
Is that? Does anybody know for sure?
Okay, Brianna says yes.
And it will be a slide presentation, I'm sure, along with the lecture. It's very near. The French Cultural Institute is, or center, is on Jebel Ouaddi, very near Halas Circle. Do you know, I think the most recognizable landmark is a university bookstore, which is a large bookstore stationery shop. It's on the main road leading into Palace Circle, coming from the west. Just maybe 50 meters off the circle. You have to go up a flight of stairs. It's on the second floor. Near the university bookstore, right?
Which side is it? On the right?
I think it's on the circle side.
It's on the left.
On the left.
Left
drive. Oh, as you're driving towards us with the one on the right. It's on the left, a little bit beyond the university bookstore, right?
Same building.
Okay, that is on February 25th. That's this Thursday.
6:30.
Okay. One other thing I wanted to mention is with the readings, if during the course of the week you have any trouble with the readings or have any questions, just jot down notes and I'll be happy to to respond to those questions during the lecture time. I'm sure that if you have a question, that somebody else would probably also be interested in those questions. I might also say that I really didn't expect everybody to do all of the readings. There's quite a bit there. One of the reasons for including so many readings was that in the future, if you want to go back to the syllabus and do some readings, I thought that might be a valuable resource for you. Okay, tonight we have the second half, more or less, of our introductory lecture dealing with chronology, archaeological, biblical, geographical terms, and then tomorrow night we'll really get into the archaeology and biblical history part, dealing with prehistory as archaeology sees it and prehistory according to the biblical text. One thing that I meant to do last week, and that was just recap what Hans Franken says about the development of archaeological research in Syria-Palestine, and he lays it out fairly concisely, I think, by pointing to the fact that your earliest excavators were the so-called tunnelers. If you remember, Charles Warren, the 1860s, followed this method, tunneling down beside walls and so forth. Tunnelers are restricted pretty much to the turn of the century. The so-called sequence daters come next, typified by people like Sir Flinders Petrie and his followers. And sequence dating was really the way of excavating through arbitrary levels, usually a half meter deep, from about 1895, actually right on up to the end of the mandate, around 1948. Another group that I failed to mention, but it is a very important archaeological tradition in this part of the world, is the architect archaeologist. Franken says that these are primarily the British, the Germans, and the French. I think that's a little bit unfair because the Americans are also engaged in this type of archaeology. Again, rather than paying a lot of attention to the levels or to artifactual pottery analysis and so forth, the architect archaeologists have had a tendency to concentrate on monumental buildings and the rapid clearance of monumental buildings, stretching around walls and dating the buildings according to the architecture rather than the artifacts. In fact, most of the archaeologists in this tradition are architects rather than what you might call a regular field archaeologist or ceramics expert. And then finally, the stratigraphic excavators, which you can say are almost exclusively post-mandate or after 1948. Now that can be a little bit misleading as well, because to say that since 1948 everybody has been digging in Syria-Palestine stratigraphically is not really true. That's one of the problems we have today. In spite of the fact that archaeology has matured a lot in recent years, there's an awful lot of excavation that still goes on, in which careful attention is not paid to the soil strata. Okay. I would like to turn attention now quickly to this handout that we gave last week on Palestinian chronology. And if you don't have it, could you raise your hand and I think we can get some copies to you. Okay, everybody's got it? Yeah. Oh, you don't have one? Okay, right. Sure. If you didn't hear the question, he was saying that these dates vary about 50 years from the ones that Jim used in his class. Actually, what I've done, rather than come up with my own numbers, I've just taken this from Paul Lapp's book entitled The Tale of the Tell. which was written 10 years ago. There are a number of points in here that you could argue, and in fact, as we go through, I want to point a few of those things out. One of the things I like about this is the numbers are rounded off. It's fairly easy to remember most of the numbers. I think for most of us, 50 years really isn't going to make a whole lot of difference when we're talking about the following years. Okay, first of all, just to notice what he says on the Paleolithic. Paleolithic he has going from 2 million years ago up until 10,000 years ago. That we need to revise, and I'd like to make a few comments on that. First of all, we can say that the Paleolithic period, is, at least as far as world archaeology is concerned, certainly goes back probably 3 million years, at least in Africa. In this part of the world, it's difficult to put the Paleolithic period back more than 1 million years. At least we don't have evidence of more than 1 million years. I don't see Gary here, but in fact, I think that the oldest material that we have here is Rubidia, which is about 600,000 years ago. So although the Paleolithic may well go back to 1 million years ago, at this point it only goes back to around 600,000, maybe 700,000 years ago. The Paleolithic period then is divided up into three different stages or levels. That is first the Upper Paleolithic from, say, 1 million to about 75,000. Now again, this sometimes you'll see, excuse me, you're right. Okay, right. This is one thing I was going to warn everybody about, because that's a common mistake that confused Lower Paleolithic with Upper Paleolithic. That was right. Lower Paleolithic from 1 million to 75,000. What's that? Right. Middle Paleolithic from about 75,000 to about 30,000. And Upper Paleolithic from about 30,000 to 17,000. What did Jim have? About 14? Again, almost everybody you read will have a little different chronology.
Gary said 80.
You know, that's what I was thinking. Gary said 80. I asked him at lunch today, and he said 75. So
tell him in his notes, he said 80 to 35, and 35,000.
Jim says 70 to 14. So
it just goes to show how far you can trust an archaeologist. He'll speak very authoritatively, but none of us agree.
It seems to be the digit 5 is him. He's real.
Yeah. Okay, now another point that could be argued over would be the next thing Lapp says about the Mesolithic period. Most prehistorians working in this part of the world today don't like to use the term Mesolithic for a number of reasons, and instead use the term the Epi-Paleolithic, which means the end of the Paleolithic period, not wanting to make quite as much of a distinction between the Paleolithic and what follows, the Neolithic. So the Epi-Paleolithic, again, let's take a consensus, roughly 17,000 to about 10,000 BC. Oh, and this is the person with our hand up. Great. Thank you very much. So if we're going to use the term epipaleolithic, then we'll probably drop the term Mesolithic. And whereas Lapp says Mesolithic from 10,000 to 8,000, other people would say from 10,000 on, you're in either the early Neolithic or the proto-Neolithic. Proto is a nice word, especially for some periods that you don't know exactly what to call them. Like just before the urban period, it's not really the urban period here, so you call them the proto-Neolithic. Yeah.
Can you explain some of the techniques for dating?
In fact, we are going to be talking about that a little bit later this evening. Okay, so as far as I'm concerned, I don't care what you call between 10,000 and 8,000, if it's proto-Neolithic or early Neolithic. Once you get into the Neolithic that we've got described here, there's a little bit more consensus. Almost everybody would agree that the pre-pottery Neolithic runs from 8,000 BC to 6,000 BC. And is divided in two. You have pre-pottery Neolithic A, or if you want to sound really professional, PPNA, from 8,000 to 7,000 BC, and then pre-pottery Neolithic B, or PPNB, which is the date of the Iron Gazal site on the east edge of Amman, from 7,000 to 6,000 BC. Then you get into the pottery Neolithic from 6,000. Again, people will start the Chalcolithic at different times. We have here 4,300, some people would say 4,500 BC, whatever. Obviously, the reason for making a distinction between pre-pottery Neolithic and pottery Neolithic is that between 5 and 6,000, pottery is introduced for the first time. That's the period at which pottery is invented. Thus, the pottery Neolithic. One thing you'll notice about all of these terms, at least in the early periods, is that the archaeological periods are labeled according to the materials that were used primarily for weapons, to a certain extent, agricultural tools. But weapons and jewelry seem to be the two things that, for example, metals are first used for, and not until they become quite common are they used for agricultural tools or things that the average person can purchase. So in the earliest period, Paleolithic, the old Stone Age, when stone is a major tool or implement of war and agriculture, Mesolithic, the middle Stone Age, Neolithic is the new Stone Age. Then you get into Chalcolithic, and the Chalcolithic is a combination of calco, the beginning of the Copper Age, but they're still using stone, so it's a copper stone age. Although we'll be dealing with all of these periods in detail, starting tomorrow, or not detail, but more detail than tonight, just to mention that during the Paleolithic and Mesolithic period, primarily people are hunters and gatherers. They're not living in one place, they're following large herds of animals, they're living off wild plants that they gather, and then they move on. So you might have a certain area where they're living for a short amount of time, but then moving on with the following the wild plant harvest and animal herds. By the Neolithic, not only do you have the invention of pottery, but one of the most important developments in the history of mankind, the so-called Neolithic Revolution, which simply stated was a time in which we believe people started domesticating plants and animals. And of course, one of the ramifications of the domestication of plants and animals was that for the first time people could settle down and live in one place all year round. Because by raising their own livestock and raising their own crops, varying their crops, they could make sure that they would have sustenance the entire year. In the Chalcolithic period, as we mentioned, copper comes into use. Although it should be noted that when you get into the so-called metallic ages, like the Chalcolithic period, the early bronze, late bronze, iron age, and so forth, it's a little bit misleading. You might think that in the Chalcolithic age, the copper age, copper becomes a very important, very dominant material. In fact, it is present, but it's not all that common. It's not common until later. Also, in the early Bronze Age, there's very little bronze in the early Bronze Age. Part of that is due to the fact that the early archaeologists would see a little green, rusty piece of metal and thought that it was bronze and called it bronze, when in fact it was copper. Copper is more common in the early bronze than bronze is. So it's not until the middle bronze that bronze comes important. In the Iron Age, iron is introduced, but bronze is still much more common in Iron One than iron is. This has caused a lot of debate among archaeologists, thinking, well, maybe we should redefine the terms. That, I don't think, is necessary, because all the terms, in a sense, are arbitrary. But just remember that the terms don't necessarily mean that during the Iron Age, iron is the most important metal, and so forth. Okay, in the Chalcolithic Age, copper is introduced. Most people, by this time, are settled agriculturalists, living in small, unfortified villages, relying primarily on subsistence agriculture.
David,
yeah.
You were saying copper meets copper, is it?
Yes. Yeah, all of these are actually the Neolithic.
It means copper stone.
Yeah, the copper stone age, and that's actually incorrect when I have your parentheses copper age. Okay, by the end of the Chalcolithic period, you come to the end of the so-called prehistoric period in this part of the world. Again, people will use the term prehistoric in different ways. If you read the article on prehistory of Palestine in the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, that person, who's a very well-known prehistorian, says that the prehistoric period is applied only to the Paleolithic period. After the Paleolithic, in other words, by the Neolithic, you're in the historical period. I don't quite like that definition, because it's not until the early Bronze Age that writing is invented. And if at least we normally equate the historical period with the time at which people start, maybe not writing history, but at least writing. So, I think most people would include the Neolithic and Chalcolithic periods in the prehistoric periods. And usually, as I'm talking, that's the way in which I would use that term. Although, in some of the literature, you will see prehistoric restricted only to the Paleolithic period. Yeah, when writing was started. Again, here we have another problem. On the one hand, you can say writing begins in the early Bronze period. That's one of the features or important characteristics of the early Bronze Age. The problem with talking about Palestine entering the historical period at that point is that we have no evidence that people in Palestine were literate during the early Bronze Age. The Sumerians were writing up in Mesopotamia, about the Persian Gulf. Also, the Egyptians were writing hieroglyphics by the early Bronze Age. Maybe they were writing here in Palestine. But at least as far as I know, Ted, or anybody know of any exceptions to that?
China.
Al says down. China? Okay, right. But again, that's where you get the problem that to say that the early Bronze Age is the point at which the historical period begins. We're always entering the historical period at different parts of the world at different times. And that's why this chronology could only be applied to Palestine. There are people today that are still in the Neolithic period, using the same types of tools that people here were using during the Neolithic period. So there's other groups that you could classify as being in the Iron Age. So we do need to be careful about making equations. One thing that I should also point out, if you look at the early Bronze Age, you'll notice that, I didn't include all the numbers, but EB1A goes from 3,200, some debate, most people would say, to 3,050. So 150-year period. And then under early Bronze 1C, I think generally people would say 2950 to 2850. There are different reasons for dividing periods up like this. At some times, you find a brand new pottery tradition coming in. At other times, you'll find what appears to be a culture dying out. Between EB1A and EB1B, about the only difference is the introduction of painted pottery. The pottery before that time is plain. It will have a slip on it very often, but it's not painted with the root lines that come in EB1B. So there's all different reasons for making these various divisions within the various periods. As you can see by should mention one other thing. Along with the invention of writing, very important phenomena in the early Bronze Age here in Palestine is the growth of fortified cities. It's the first truly urban period in Syria-Palestine. We do have examples of fortifications, say, at Neolithic Jericho, but few people would argue that that's a real urban culture. The early Bronze Age is generally thought to be the first time you can really speak about urbanization in this part of the world. And as you can see, towards the end of the early Bronze Age, again, you get into some very confusing terminology. And I hope that what I've done here helps clarify things rather than confuse things further. Most Americans go by the terminology here, EB13, and then EB3, and then EB4, beginning with Middle Bronze 1, around 2050 or 2000. Kathleen Kenyon and a lot of the British, however, don't like the terminology EB4, and the main reason is that at the end of EB3, the urban culture of Syria-Palestine is destroyed. Most of the cities seem to have been destroyed or abandoned. And therefore, she feels that that marks the end of a major period. And then rather than continuing on to EB4 and then making the separation around 2000, she says, rather, we ought not to talk about EB4, but rather an intermediate bronze period. So she has Intermediate Bronze 1, Intermediate Bronze 2. Her Intermediate Bronze 1 is the same as what Americans would call EB4. Her Intermediate Bronze 2 is the same as what most Americans would call Middle Bronze 1. And then her Middle Bronze 1 is what most Americans would call Middle Bronze 2A. And then by Middle Bronze 2B, then you get back to the same. It's all terribly confusing. I think the only way that this is all going to be sorted out, Kathleen Kenyon has now died, so she can't defend her own thesis. And maybe when some of these giants get out of the picture, we'll get a little bit more of a consensus. I don't know that it's really necessary to go through every period here. Might just mention that most people would say that the Middle Bronze period is probably the time of patriarchs of the Old Testament, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The Late Bronze Age is a period in which Egypt strongly dominated this part of the world. It's also the period that most people would place, right at the end of the Late Bronze period, place the Exodus from Egypt and the Israelite conquest of the land of Canaan. And with the Iron Age, you enter into what you could call the height of the biblical Old Testament period, with first the period of the tribal confederacy, the judges, followed by the rise of the monarchy with Saul, David, Solomon, and so forth. You see, the Iron Age 1 ends at 918, which, again, that's a cultural event, not a real break in the pottery, but what happens in 918 is Shishak invades from Egypt. Should point out that although Lapp calls the period between 587 and 539 the exilic period, a lot of other people call it the Iron Three period. I actually prefer Iron Three or some term other than exilic, because of course exilic is a reference exclusively to the southern kingdom of Judah. And in fact, during the same period, you have the Ammonites living on in the vicinity of Ammon, and they did not go into exile in Babylon. So referring to using a term like exilic and applying it to all people that are living in the area, even if they didn't have the same experience, I think is not too accurate. Should mention one other thing: as you read the different literature, you'll notice very often that Israeli archaeologists will not, sometimes they'll use this terminology, early bronze, middle bronze, late bronze, Iron Age, but there is a tendency to refer to the Bronze Age as the Canaanite period and the Iron Age as the Israelite period. I hope that that tendency never gains a lot of support, because what it does is, again, defines the terms, the periods in terms of a specific ethnic or political group. And certainly I would think a viable Jordanian reaction to that would be to say, well, we want to call them, instead of the Iron Age, we'll call it the Ammonite period. And in Kerak, they'd say, well, we're going to call the Iron Age the Moabite period, because that's where they were centered, and down at Okay, after the Iron Three, then you'll notice that the titles for the chronology change. Instead of referring to the material from which implements were made, you suddenly start naming the periods after the major empires that ruled the area. So from 539 to 332 is the Persian period, followed by the Hellenistic period when the Greeks ruled the area, followed by the Roman period, Byzantine, and so forth. And this course will actually only be going up through the early Roman period, to around 135. So I think we'd be fairly safe in saying that by 135, all of the biblical documents, even the New Testament books, have been written, or at least soon after that period. Okay. I'd like you to turn attention now very quickly to this handout you just received, a biblical timeline. And we made reference to that already, and as we go along in the course, we'll be going into more detail, but I think this might just make it clearer, easier to remember that, again, most people would say that the Middle Bronze Age, and within the Middle Bronze Age, roughly between 1900 and 1700, is the patriarchal period. To be a little more precise, most people would date Abraham to around 1750. With the new discoveries up in Ebla, there are a few scholars that are saying, no, the patriarchs must belong to the early Bronze Age, as early as 2400. We will discuss that when we're discussing the early Bronze period. But the consensus is the patriarchs would date around 1750. From the patriarchs in Egypt, Joseph and all of his descendants, that's roughly between 1700 and about 1300. Most scholars would date the exodus from Egypt during the Late Bronze Age, near the end of the Late Bronze Age, that is leaving Egypt around 1290, something like that, and arriving in the Promised Land around 1250. The only thing we know for sure is that there is an Egyptian inscription, the Menephta stele, which dates to around 1220, I believe it is. And that's the first extra-biblical reference we have to Israel, or the Israelites. So we know that at least by 1220, there were Israelites in Palestine. King David is fairly well dated to around 1000 in the Iron One period, and followed by King Solomon. That, of course, is a period of the united monarchy, when all of the Israelite tribes are together under David and Solomon, from 1000 to 922. So a period of a little less than 80 years. At the death of Solomon, the Israelite tribes break apart into a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. Soon after that split, Shishak invaded, no doubt trying to take advantage of the weakness of the Israelite tribes at that point. Then as you look down on the bottom line, you can see the continuation of the northern kingdom continues until 721, when Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom, is destroyed by the Assyrians. The southern kingdom escaped destruction at that time by the skin of its teeth, continued on until Jerusalem was besieged by the Babylonians, and the first deportation took place in 598, and then finally Jerusalem was destroyed, and the so-called Babylonian exile took place in 587. We'll continue on later, but at least this takes us up to the period that we'll be dealing with in the next 4 or 5 lectures.
Are you going to break the Iron Age period down into historical events as opposed to modern day?
We'll be doing both, but again, we'll be paying more attention to the historical events than the analysis of pottery. Both because I think that quite a number of you have studied that carefully, probably know more about it than I do. And I think, dealing with the history and the archaeology moment. Okay, I want to say a little bit now about dating. It's one of the questions that you often get is, how can you actually tell how old something is? I'd like to say a few words about different materials used in dating and different techniques. I mentioned last time that starting with Petrie, who recognized the importance of stratigraphy, that was recognized that as you excavated a tell, the lower you got, the older the material was. So that is at least the basis for so-called relative chronology. That is, you may not know exactly the date of everything you're finding, but you do know that the lower you get, roughly, the earlier the material is. There was a lot of confusion in the early days, in the early part of the century, because people were using different techniques and there wasn't that much communication between archaeologists. That's still a problem today, in fact, getting archaeologists to share the information they have and let them each other look at their materials. There was William Albright in 1926 to 1932 in his work at Tel Beit Mirsan. The EITMIRSIM, who brought more or less order to Palestinian ceramic typology or chronology. It's amazing that although his chronology has been refined, and this is primarily restricted to the early Bronze Age through the Iron Age, although his typology, ceramic typology, has been refined, still holds up pretty well, amazingly well, for such a pioneering effort. both Albright, Petrie, and all of the early archaeologists were primarily getting a relative chronology, a relative dating. Every once in a while, they would find something which would help them date absolutely the pottery. For example, if they would find a coin in this level related to particular pottery forms, they would know and say that level down here is a Constantinian, Byzantine level. Every once in a while, a clay tablet can give you a date and so forth. It was a slow process, but after assembling a lot of these absolute dates or objects that you can date absolutely, it got to the point where just from the pottery alone, you can tell how old a certain level is. The advantage that pottery has, even over coins, inscriptions, and so forth, is one, it's much more abundant. It's very seldom that you find a clay tablet here in Palestine, or even a coin. But pottery you find every place because it is cheap, it's easy to make, it's expendable. Once it's broken, you don't go to the trouble of mending it and trying to reuse it. It's much easier just to make a new pot. So that's one of the great advantages of pottery, is that it's so so abundant. Also, it's virtually indestructible, or can be destroyed, but it lasts for an awful long time. And then finally, it is so easy to modify. As you're throwing the pot, you can easily make a new form or modify an old form. It seems from the most ancient times, people have always been fashion conscious and always want to do something new. And pottery reflects that tendency in man to always want to make slight changes in things. And so that you do see changes in pottery very often every 25 or 50 years. And the most important pieces of pottery that you're looking at are usually the bases, rims, handles, shoulders, which are called diagnostic sherds or indicator sherds. Sometimes you can actually use the wear and the decoration and so forth also to date a piece of pottery. Decoration isn't too helpful here in Palestine because a lot of pottery isn't decorated. At least not like it was so frequently in Greece and other places. I want to give you an example here. I realize this board isn't that easy to see in certain places, but try to draw a dark thing. I want to try to illustrate how easy it is to date features like a wall from pottery, and how difficult it can be if you don't excavate it properly. If you don't already know, you'll soon find out that my artistic ability is very limited. And that's a stone wall. Okay, this again is theoretical, but it's something that you could find in an excavation. Say all of these horizontal lines are floors, say plaster floors, with pottery that you can date very easily to the Middle Bronze Period, Late Bronze Period, Iron Age I, and Iron Age II. Another thing that you'll often find when you find an ancient wall is a foundation trench. Usually the foundation trench would come to the very bottom, although sometimes you do find trenches that come down just near the bottom and they're laid in below. The question is, if this is a middle bronze floor, this is a late bronze floor, an iron one floor, and an iron two floor, And this is the foundation trench, which contained Chalcolithic pottery, late bronze pottery, and middle bronze pottery. What is the date of the wall? You really don't have to be an archaeologist to figure this out. If you just look at it and try to figure logically. Okay. This, in the foundation trench, you have a combination of Chalcolithic pottery, late bronze, middle bronze. Yeah, not in that order, just all mixed together. This is middle bronze floor, late bronze floor, iron one floor, iron two floor.
You got them all.
Yeah, I got them all. Anybody want to make a strong defense for...
Earliest. It fell to the bottom of the trench. It was in use at the time that people dug the trench. Any of the earlier artifacts would have been the soil they dug up to put the foundation.
That's a good point. So you can't date a wall by the earliest pottery you find in association with it, right? You've got to date it by the latest pottery. So you could think that this could be a late bronze wall then, right? From the foundation trench by itself, that's what it would appear with this late bronze. But again, I kind of tried to get a little tricky here. If it were a late bronze wall, you would expect the floor to go right up to the wall. But in fact, the foundation trench cuts through the late bronze floor and is sealed by iron one floor. So theoretically, again, you would expect you might well find iron age one pottery in the foundation trench as well, because that would be contemporary with the wall. It would have to be an iron one wall, since the floor goes up and connects, and the foundation trench cuts through the late bronze level. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
I just made this up, so I may be wrong. And of course, it couldn't be an iron two wall, because the iron two level seals right over it. Okay, now one other point, and that is a critique of the architectural archaeologist, as we were talking about that, the tendency to to follow walls and dig both sides of the wall so you get a nice exposure on the whole building, so a tourist can come in and look and see how nice it is. Problem is, if you would tunnel along this wall, what you'd end up doing is having a section like that. Hopefully you wouldn't destroy the wall. But okay, so here you've got iron one, LB, and MB. Suddenly, it's the width of there. Suddenly you've got a nice wall, but you have no idea whether, if all of these surfaces came up to touch it. In that case, it may be a middle bronze wall that was reused in all those successive periods. Or if it did have a foundation trench cutting these, or maybe it had a foundation trench cutting this, or a foundation trench here. So I think it's fairly clear why digging carefully and using the pottery to take the architecture is very important. In fact, you can use, and some people do use, the architecture to date a site. The problem is that architectural styles last for a long time. At least they don't change as rapidly as pottery forms do. So you might be able to tell, well, by the floor plan and the means of laying stones, this is obviously an early Bronze Age temple. But you're not going to be able to date that as precisely within the early bronze as you are if you have pottery associated with it. You can say, well, that's EB1 pottery, it must be an EB1 wall. Another means of dating archaeological finds is literary evidence, The problem with literary evidence, again, in this part of the world, is you don't get it that often. But there are a few examples. In 1 Kings, the Old Testament book of 1 Kings, chapter 16, verse 23 and 24, you get the statement that the city of Samaria, which was the capital of the northern kingdom, was founded in the 7th year of Omri's reign. Well, we know when Omri was living, so we can say that the city of Samaria, according to the biblical text, was founded around 870 BC. Also in 2 Kings, chapter 17, verses 5 and 6, as well as in the annals of the Assyrian king Sargon II, we're told that Samaria was destroyed by Sargon in 721 BC. That's a tremendous help to an archaeologist. When you're digging at Samaria, you find a nice destruction layer. The pottery in that destruction is iron II pottery, and you have a literary reference dating it to a specific year. Again, you can't be absolutely sure that that biblical date is correct, but at least it gives you more precision than you would usually have. Another example like this is in the book of 1 Kings, chapter 9. Verse 15, we're told that Solomon ordered the refortification of the walls of Jerusalem, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. The excavations at Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer have revealed Iron Age gateways that are almost identical in plan. And it would appear quite likely, again, going from the biblical text, that those are in fact Solomonic gates that the biblical text. So manuscript evidence can be very helpful. The problem is you don't find that much of it that you can actually date precisely. Sometimes you do find ostracon or ostraca. Now, an ostracon is a potsherd which has writing on it. Potsherds in ancient times were very often used like scratch paper or receipts, bills, various transactions, and so forth. They're written usually in ink, so they don't, all that writing doesn't survive. The problem with ostracon is, again, very seldom do they mention kings, and it's usually by the mention of kings that you can arrive at a precise date. Still, from the style of writing on an ostracon, and in some ancient manuscripts, you can also use that as a method of dating. The Dead Sea Scrolls, in fact, were dated not because they had specific references to political leaders, but because of the style of the script. Inscriptions, of course, also are an important means of dating. As far as the writing in an inscription, it's much more stylized, and it doesn't change as rapidly as cursive or handwriting does. So unless your inscription does refer to a certain king, it's hard to date it by the style of writing. Also, you can't always trust that an inscription says this building was built in 350 BC. I mean, it's not going to say BC, obviously, but it was built during the reign of so-and-so. You have to be careful because very often blocks are reused. And all you need to do is go up to Kasr Halabak to see that. You can find there a very long Greek inscription that spread through four or five different buildings. And finally, a problem with inscriptions, again here in Jordan, Palestine, is the fact that they're so rare. We just don't have that many to rely upon. Other things that can be used as dating, tools for dating are scarabs, seal impressions, and coins. Especially coins, people have a tendency to think that's really the best way to date a site. But there are some problems with coins as well. One of the problems is that coins are very small, and it's very easy for a coin to slip through a crack or into a rodent hole and get into a deeper level than it originally existed in. So in other words, if you would find a nice floor just covered with late bronze pottery, and you found a Byzantine coin in the middle of all that pottery, chances are you should go with the pottery rather than the coin, even though the coin may give you a definite year. course, on the other hand, if you find a lot of coins in one or two late bronze pots, then the chances are you're going to go to the podium. So, yeah. Scarab, actually, Mrs. Veets can demonstrate this maybe afterwards. She's got a scarab ring. It's a little, used as a little signet ring. It looks like a bug on the back. You take it off, flip it over, stamp your John Henry onto a wax seal or clay tablet, and it's used as kind of an official seal, as well as a nice piece of jewelry. I think you probably use it more as a piece of jewelry. another problem with coins also is that they have a tendency to stay in circulation a lot of time. I would imagine there's some of you that have 100, 200-year-old coins, maybe 2,000-year-old coins. You know, if your house falls down tomorrow and we excavate it 10 years from now, hopefully we'll be able to tell that it's a 20th century house rather than a Byzantine house, even though you may have 2,000 Constantinian coins. Stone objects, again, can be used to a certain extent for dating purposes, but certainly objects like stone bowls or coins, grinding stones, are used for a long time without changing style. The same is true with flints. Gary can certainly, much better than most of the rest of us, can date flint implements. On the other hand, there are certain type of implements like hand axes that are used for hundreds of thousands of years. I'm sure there would be some cases of hand axes that Gary would say, well, I can't date that anymore, any closer than 50,000 years. Even when you get into the later periods, Chalcolithic, early bronze period, it can be very difficult to distinguish between a Chalcolithic and an early bronze blade or a scraper. Whereas the pottery, you might be able to tell within 100 years, very easily, tell within 100 years, the date of the surface. The flint tools aren't that much helpful for dating purposes. We've already mentioned architecture, the limitations of architecture. Art styles sometimes also are very helpful, but again, there's not much art in ancient Palestine. Some people, again, the early archaeologists would often explain the absence of decoration on the pottery was probably due to the second commandment, the Israelite restriction against any graven images. The problem with that theory is that there's not much decoration on the pre-Israelite pottery, the pottery, the Canaanite pottery. Okay, more recently, there have been a number of modern development techniques for dating, such as carbon-14, which you can date through laboratory analysis, anything that was or is organic, in other words, bones, textiles, plants, so forth. Also, thermoluminescence analysis is used to determine the date of pottery by determining the date at which it was fired. Potassium argon dating is used to date igneous rocks, which can sometimes be very helpful if you find a volcanic eruption has covered a place like Pompeii, and you can date the actual date of the lava that flowed over the place. The problem with, again, all of these modern techniques, well, there's various problems. Certainly with carbon-14, one of the big drawbacks is that you totally destroy the sample that you're testing. And if you have a few, at least in my opinion, precious little wheat grains, and you want to run a C14 date on it, the only way you can do it is to completely destroy the sample. The same with thermoluminescence analysis. Although even more important probably is the expense involved. It's just too expensive to run massive numbers of C14 dates and thermoluminescence data. So what you generally find is all these modern techniques are used, and they're very valuable, using them as checks for your pottery readings. But in the end, I think you'll find, everybody will agree, that pottery remains the most important tool for dating ancient occupational layers. Of course, one other advantage of pottery is that you can use pottery not only to date things, but you can very often follow the migrations of people by following the broken pots they left behind, as well as identifying ancient trade routes. Something I was going to do, but we're running short of time, so I'll just point it out to you and just leave it up to you as to whether or not you're that interested in it. That is to talk about archaeological terms. In the back of this little book by Hans Franken, who has excavated at Murano, the Pyramid of Old Testament Archaeology, he has a two-page glossary, which is very helpful, especially if you have no background in archaeology, tell you what a bulk is, what a section is, what a top plan is, an ostracon slip, and things like that. Also, this little book, The Old Testament and the Historian, both of these are on the Sorbonne Library. In the back of it, it has several appendices, which gives the major characteristic of the different archaeological periods. He also has a nice little chronological table with the kings of Judah and the kings of Israel. But I don't think we'll go into that in such great detail because it just gets very complicated. Okay, just a couple words about this second handout, and then we'll call it quits. And I'm not going to take the time to read through this, but there are a few things that I would like to emphasize. This is a simple definition of common terms. Okay, Mesopotamia. First of all, I think you'll all be familiar with the fact that Mesopotamia refers to, technically, the land between the two rivers, that is, between the Euphrates and the Tigris. In fact, we usually don't use the term in such a narrow sense. It's usually includes all of the land of the valley, Tigris, Euphrates Valley, from the Persian Gulf up in here. Alluvial plain. The Fertile Crescent is a term you'll run into frequently during this course. That runs all the way from the Persian Gulf up to the bend of the Euphrates, down through ancient Canaan, Palestine, and again, it's kind of hard to tell. Most people would extend the Fertile Crescent right into the Nile Delta, right around the coastline. That's very important, certainly historically, and for understanding the Bible. One thing that drives me nuts when, especially you'll hear this with radio preachers, talking about some of the old biblical prophecies, and about how the world's going to come to the end in a few years, and referring to an old prophecy that the enemy is coming from the north, and of course the enemy is the Russians, and they're coming down from the north. If you look closely in the Old Testament, there's a very, very obvious reason why the enemy always comes from the north, and it's because of the Fertile Crescent. Right, it's the only way they could get there. So when, say, the Babylonians who were here east of Palestine, they would not invade from the east. They'd have to go all the way across the desert and follow the crescent up and then come down to the north. So whether it was the Babylonians or the Hittites or the Akkadians, the Assyrians, whoever it was, it didn't matter where they came from, your ancient Israelite would turn around and say, watch out, here comes the enemy from the north. But that's the way everybody came down. And of course, there was a rather constant barrage of armies of different nations marching back and forth. Again, it was usually battles between Egyptians and the major powers in the north. Unfortunately, the Palestine lay right in the middle. And of course, everybody knows you don't like to fight your own battles in the territory. Palestine has always been such a battleground. Okay, a couple other terms that I don't know if they'll be familiar to you or not. Cisjordan, in some of the readings you'll come across that. Cisjordan is a geographical term referring to all of the land to the west of the Jordan River, of Tiberias, Jordan River, and the Dead Sea. Transjordan is one of those terms that different authors use differently. A lot of people will